Welcome to Nonprofits. It's 2018. This is our first podcast of the new year. Actually, that's not true. We did an interview that will be coming out soon, which we really enjoyed, but we wanted to get this out first and just sort of catch up on politics. My name's Atif.
I'm Robert.
I'm Scott.
A few things we want to talk about, but first, Robert, you live in Hawaii.
I do.
Hawaii's been in the news.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk about Hawaii? How your bunker's coming?
Not well. You know, I actually... So everyone heard about the emergency, the false emergency alert that we got. I was woken up at 8 a.m. with this message on my phone saying, missile inbound to Hawaii. And I'd thought about what I would do if we got that alert. And it turns out my plans were not very good.
Yeah.
It was traumatic, I think, for a lot of people. And if there's any salutary effect, we're now maybe thinking about more seriously about civil defense and disaster planning here.
Yeah. Do you see that Pornhub spiked after it was called off?
Pornhub, at first, the traffic on the from Hawaii to porn sites dropped dramatically.
Right.
And you know, there's that thing about like, oh, the world is ending. You know, why don't we just go and make love while the bombs fall? That was not my feeling at all.
I'm not sure Pornhub and make love.
No, okay, whatever.
But sure.
Well, anyway, I mean, maybe right. If you had just had a few minutes left and you didn't have a partner, you'd be you know what?
Yeah.
But that, like, theoretically,
right.
I can see someone making that case, but right. I didn't find it very sexy at all, really, to get the, there's a potentially a nuclear missile coming alarm. One of the things that, that really struck me, so we had guests visiting. Guests came from California, some friends of mine, with their kids. And I kept thinking, their kids are here. They wouldn't have been here 2 days ago.
Right.
If they weren't here, you know, like they came out to visit me.
Right.
And of course, it's unfair that any of us should be in the line of fire. But it was just, I couldn't, all I could think about was, what do I need to do to help the people around
me? Sure.
Maybe it would be different if I were just alone.
Right.
But it was like, what step do I need to take? And the truth is, there's no good option. Like they don't, we don't have, you're supposed to, the Hawaii recommends you get into a concrete building, preferably a basement. And that's great, great recommendation. But unless you live downtown, they don't have those. These are all wooden buildings built above ground. They're basically like functionally, I think, not that different from the buildings in Hiroshima in 1945.
Huh.
They're not going to provide you a lot of protection from thermal radiation, from, you know, ultraviolet radiation, from a blast, nothing.
Wait, hold on. Let me stop for a second. Why are there no basements?
I don't really know. I mean, a lot of this isn't granite. I think, I don't know exactly, but it's like volcanic rock.
Okay.
And it doesn't, I don't know. They just, for whatever reason.
But it's just not a thing.
They don't really build basements on your standard house. We don't need like storm cellars to protect against the wind. Actually, I think flooding could be an issue. We have very heavy rains.
But I was thinking of another thing that I grew up in Oregon and we didn't have a basement because basically there was no need to. We didn't need to shelter from tornadoes. And in St. Louis, you have the possibility of tornadoes. And so I think it's like a natural thing to build down a little bit.
Right. Yeah, maybe maybe it's that. But I don't think it's sort of like, I don't think of basements as shelter. I think of them as additional space, like, you know, vertical space that doesn't require you.
Sure, but you can dig down or you can dig up and or, you know, not dig up, you can build up.
Yeah, I think it's cheaper in some ways.
And we tend to build up. Also, when I lived in Seattle, we went up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the truth is, I don't really know the answer to that question.
Sure.
We had this idea that we were going to go into the sewer that actually runs through like a patch of jungle behind the house. And I thought that would be a much better place for any kind of blast and also for, you know, eventually for fallout or something. Hawaii does not recommend you go into the sewers. And they were very like, don't do that. I'm not entirely sure why. I guess sewage could potentially explode. Although if there's going to be an explosion anyway. But I think the real reason is they just like that's not designed as a shelter. Which is fine, but there's nowhere that's designed in a shelter.
I wonder if this is an issue of, if it really was a bomb, it'd be better to go into the sewer.
Right.
But if there are occasional bad calls, you're going to get people sick and probably injured going into sewers.
Right. I think that's probably it. They don't want to be responsible for what's going to happen to me if I go down in the sewer under normal circumstances. But anyway, I couldn't get into the sewer. We don't have a crowbar, and you can't really lift it up with just your fingers. So we basically, after 10 minutes, we're standing around in the middle of our living room, being like, are we waiting for death? Like, I don't know. Like, you know, we weren't really doing anything that was useful, except for maybe staying away from windows. That's when I finally went on Twitter. The big anomalous thing was that we have these new sirens, new missile attack sirens, and they weren't sounding. And, you know, we turn on the news, and I guess some people saw emergency alert messages on the news. That's not what we got when we turned on the news. So there was nothing to confirm this. And finally on Twitter, Tulsi Gabbard, our congressional representative for the 2nd District in Hawaii, tweeted that it was a false alarm that she checked. That was about like 12 minutes after the original thing went out. But for about 12 minutes, I thought realistically that we could all die. Or, you know, most people probably won't die. Most people won't be near the center of the blast, but be very severely injured. You know, I had read Hiroshima, John Hersey's Hiroshima, a few years ago, and I kept thinking about the people who were suffering third-degree burns and radiation sickness and looking for clean water, and I thought, that could be all of us. And that was upsetting.
Yeah.
And there are people that will tell you, a lot of people will come up to you and say, oh, it didn't bother me. But it's funny because they start talking about it and at great length kind of tell you that they never thought it was real. It didn't bother them. But, you know, still like weeks later and they're still talking about it.
Right.
So I feel like there's a little bit of kind of like, I don't know, protesting too much. I think generally speaking, it was traumatic for the entire state of Hawaii.
Sure.
It's traumatic for me and I wasn't even there.
Yeah. So I mean, yeah, yeah. And then the whole thing, like it was a stupid mistake. And they're now kind of blaming the guy who made it.
Yeah, they fired that dude.
But they have these terrible procedures. I mean, they came in and they were at a shift change and they decided to do a test message. And now it turns out that it wasn't really clear who was being tested, if it was the outgoing or the incoming shift. So the supervisor wasn't supervising. And they also have the test message repeats the "this is not a drill" sound, but in the front of it says "exercise." So the test message is like, exercise, exercise, exercise. There's an attack coming. This is not a drill. And the guy who selected it supposedly didn't hear the words "exercise" and just heard "this is not a drill" and assumed it wasn't a drill.
Right.
And then he selected some, you know, the statewide alert message, I think intentionally, but from a super confusing, terrible user interface of options. I mean, this is going to happen eventually. It's actually not that surprising. It only took a couple of months after they implemented this system.
Yeah.
No one really got hurt, but people were driving off the freeway and one guy had a massive heart attack. It looks like he's going to recover. It was horrible. It made me think about the reality of it. And part of the reason I was personally freaked out is because I don't think it's very likely, but I also don't think that it's completely unrealistic to think that Korea could launch a nuclear missile at us. Like, I was thinking about this comparison, like, Atif, this is for you. The Denver Nuggets are a pretty good team, right? They're probably going to get in the playoffs.
Sure.
Which is more likely, that Honolulu gets hit by a nuclear missile this year or the Denver Nuggets win an NBA championship? Right? Like, they're not going to win, probably.
It's a, it's a real choice.
It's a real choice. It's unlikely, but crazier things have happened.
Yeah. No, you're right. Well, we can look at the Vegas odds and the Denver Nuggets win. I mean, it's probably Honolulu. Sorry, Denver Nuggets. Actually, I'm not sorry. Stan Kroenke, you can.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I think I would take the Minnesota Timberwolves' chances over getting hit by a missile.
One of the things that concerns me is not just that the alarm system was pretty screwed up, and we could say, yeah, that's human error, and there were mistakes in the system, but what are the sort of mistakes that would also create the situation where a live event actually happened? You know, where somebody actually did shoot off a missile, you know, because of a miscommunication. Because there's obviously been a lot of those things have happened many times in the past, and they've always been blocked between, at that time, the Soviet Union and the U.S. But still, there are numerous times now where it's basically fallen to one or two people to basically not follow an order.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Actually, Seth Baum and I are working on a paper right now that should come out relatively soon that looks at, I mean, it's sort of a model for modeling nuclear war risk or nuclear conflict risk, but it looks at those false alarms. And what I'm doing for it is really being the research assistant for the false alarms. And there are a lot.
Yeah.
And it's hard to know, like, I think people
that we know about,
right. It's actually, you can see there's certain periods where there are a ton, and that's because those are the periods where it was reported. And it, you know, some people will look at that and say, well, that's the system working because none of those false alarms were translated into conflict. You know, never escalated. But other, you know, a lot of security people look at it and say, well, that's actually, it's easy to imagine those could have. The fact that there are so many false alarms should give us real pause. And I think it is frightening. And even in this case, you can imagine that there are North Korean generals who are monitoring this, and they hear that Hawaii has put out a prepare for a missile attack warning, and they think, either that this is because the U.S. has already launched an attack, or that it's going to be used as a pretext for an attack. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe they should dismiss that. Maybe that's dumb on their part. But I don't 100% know it doesn't cause a panic in North Korea when they see what happened in Hawaii. You know, and it took Hawaii officially 38 minutes to correct it because they didn't have a system for correcting the alert. So could that have caused a war? Probably not, but not a zero chance.
So what have you done since then?
Bought a crowbar to open the sewer behind the house.
Haven't bought a respirator?
No, I mean, I guess if I'm really concerned about fallout, that's the real thing. I wanted to, I went to the dentist shortly afterwards to get a filling. And what I really wanted to do was to steal some of those lead blankets they put on you for the x-rays.
That'll work.
Just hunker down in the tub, My girlfriend was great. She started filling the tub with water. That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to make sure you have enough clean water. And I did not have that instinct, but she was right on it.
I was also curious about how we decide to spend resources, because if I thought, I have a few old respirators from having a painting company, but I don't have any cartridges for NBC, for nuclear, biological, chemical weapons. I actually have for chemical, but nothing else.
Do they have different filters? The NBC is just a filter you pop into a standard respirator?
Yes, yes. There are different filters you can put on them. And they're not very expensive. But I don't even have that up to date. And I don't have, like you were talking about, I don't have enough for my whole family. It'd be like, okay, I have one for me. I maybe have another one. What do I do, split that between the rest of the family?
You've got to put your gas mask on yourself first. It's just like on a plane.
Yeah, but this is almost a near zero cost. They're probably less than $50. And yet, obviously, we don't consider it worth doing that.
I mean, you could spend a lot of money on these things.
Sure.
I could get a Faraday bag for my electronics equipment. The truth is, there isn't a lot that we can reasonably do to prepare. We can't build shelters for the citizens of Honolulu anytime soon. And back in the Cold War, when we had shelters, they weren't great. Like, you weren't going to survive very long in them. The system wasn't set up. They weren't stocked with food. You can't really do that for very long. It just doesn't, I mean, maybe you could if you're really fighting a war, but it just doesn't, they don't maintain them well, and it's not a great solution. The real solution is to prevent it from happening.
I went on vacation once and stayed in a bomb shelter in a house. So that's in Israel.
Right. They're all required to have shelters in Israel, all the houses. Well, that's what my Israeli friend told me after this happened. He's like, move to Israel. And I'm like, no, there's a reason they have those shelters there.
Yeah. But there was actually like a usable room. So it didn't look like, you're going into the place that was never used.
Right.
It was just like, okay, here's an extra, basically that's what it was serving as, was an extra guest room. But it was also significantly expensive because the way the door was and also the ventilation on it was not typical. So it wasn't just a standard room with sort of thick walls. And once again, that's a cost that we don't consider. But even in Israel, the chance of your house being hit is pretty tiny. And yet for some reason, they made the decision that that's something they want to do. And I don't know what precipitated that.
An interesting question.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, just being faced with the reality of it, I had kind of a morbid fascination. And there's a lot of details. Like, it depends if it's a hydrogen bomb or a regular, uranium, plutonium kind of design, what kind of fallout you get. And I didn't realize before that, in some sense, with a thermonuclear bomb, with a hydrogen bomb, the radioactive elements it produces are actually hydrogen and carbon, rather than, uranium and, I don't know, strontium 90 or something. And the problem with that is those are organic elements. Those are the things that get incorporated into your body when you breathe and eat. So that kind of radiation can be really bad. It lasts for a while and you actually get it into your cells. And then you get radiation from the inside when you get those radioactive isotopes. And that's alarming to me. Some of these things you'd have to wear a mask for a long time. And it's not just the mask. You need to have, as you say, like a Tyvek suit or something ridiculous. Anyway, I'm alive.
Yep.
I'm glad you're alive, buddy.
Thank you.
One last question on this. Do you think it affects the way that you view the North Korea crisis or policy towards North Korea?
I don't know if it really changes because I'd already thought about this some.
Or the general public.
But I'm not a big fan of the bloody nose strategy.
Yeah.
They say in the news that our intelligence services don't think they can hit the U.S. for a few months. I'm not sure if Hawaii is included in that calculation, whether or not they already think they can hit the Hawaii or if they're talking about the mainland. But even if they can't hit anywhere in the U.S., I don't want to see anything launched at South Korea or Japan. I think that the idea that we could hit North Korea without a response is stupid. I don't think that's very likely. I think that North Korea almost has to respond partly just so the Kim Jong-un can maintain power, but also because they won't know what's going on. They may think it's an all-out attack. I would expect the collateral damage to be horrifying. We're talking about China and not just Korea, but China, Japan, and Russia all potentially freaking out and getting involved. This is a terrible idea. I think ordinary nuclear deterrence would work. I think it would be great if Kim Jong-un didn't have nuclear weapons, but now the cat is basically out of the bag. I would like to see regular old deterrence. Stop thinking about invading. Stop trying to regime change North Korea and use ordinary diplomacy. That's what I would do.
What are the chances of that happening?
I don't know. I don't have a lot of confidence in our current regime here. Well, on that cheery note, we should have a piece of news, which relay a piece of news. Roman Hagelstein, who we interviewed a while back, had a big profile in a German weekly magazine, Welt am Sonntag, and it was a great profile.
Can we put that on the website?
Yeah, we will absolutely put that on the website.
We have the original in a PDF format. And the reason we want to put it on the website is because super forecasters apparently are gods.
Yeah.
Gods among men.
We have superpowers.
That was a dramatic article. It was pretty amazing. Hey, Roman is great. Look, in super forecasters,
we're proud of our abilities, but it was a bit much.
Yeah. Like, you know, I don't feel like we...
This is not the way that Roman portrays himself at all.
Right.
He's actually quite skeptical about his abilities.
I think everybody should be.
Yeah.
Well, that's sort of why we do what we do, right? Like,
yeah.
Because we question ourselves, we're able to be a little bit more accurate.
Yeah, but the article certainly... And let's shout out our German friends who may be listening to this, because we had a significant uptick in our interview with Roman after that article came out.
Yeah, yeah. More. It is now... Our two podcast episodes are now the most popular episodes we've ever done. By a long shot.
What up, Germany? It was funny. Like, it was a funny... Yeah, you know, on the one hand, it's sort of like, it's cute. On the other hand, I'm like, this is not, we're not geniuses. And we know the facts.
Hey.
We know we're not geniuses. Well, I'm not a genius. And actually, Scott, I know you're not a genius, buddy. We'll talk about it later.
Okay.
But I mean, we're all, you know, it's not like we're stupid, but it's just like, the article sort of presented it like, oh, we're like, we have some extrasensory perception. And no, it's just,
right.
It's the same kind of stuff that.
We can't tell you what card you're holding.
Yeah, it's the same stuff we would like to see in politics on both sides, which is just sort of kind of a sober assessment, dispassionate assessment of evidence, critical thinking, updating with new information, not excluding information because you find it inconvenient, it makes you anxious and something like that. Like just sort of basic critical thinking skills. And I think that in my experience, you know, people who are really good at forecasting, there are some things that they tend to be good at. Compartmentalization, actually, I think is one of them. But also, you know, just sort of updating new information, paying attention to evidence, trying to be aware when you're trying to put your thumb on the scale, that kind of thing.
I don't want to undersell us. Like, I am proud of what we've managed to do.
Oh, agreed.
But
I agree.
Just the whole tone, like they had pictures of him sort of staring off into the future next to a bunch of, I think, geese. And it was just amazing.
Oh, it was great. It was like an album cover.
It's like Chauncey Gardner walking out across the water.
Yeah.
Being there.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
Thanks for subtitling. This is our annotated podcast.
We need footnotes. I miss a lot of what you guys refer to.
Scott made a reference to being there. So it's sort of related to that, related to the process of forecasting. And like I said, nonprofitspod.wordpress.com, we'll put something. By will, I mean Robert. So I should let the listener know, and this is sort of an expression of gratitude for Robert. Whenever I say, we'll put it on the website, for me, that's fire and forget. Robert always actually remembers and puts the links on the website. So thank you, buddy.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, we'll put that. We can put a link to that if anyone wants to check it out because it's interesting. And Roman is interesting. It's a kind of a cool piece. But I at least am not oracular. Coming on the heels of that, similar in time, there was a Twitter beef between Phil
Contemporaneous.
There you go, Contemporaneous. There was a Twitter beef between Phil Tetlock and Nassim Tlaib. That's how you pronounce it, right? The Black Swan guy.
Yep.
And it's of a kind. Like both of these are sort of like explorations of forecasters. Like what makes a good forecaster? What should be? What are some of the elements of good forecasting? That kind of thing. Nassim takes a very different tack. And Robert, since you actually brought this to my attention and then went through Twitter and kind of summarized everything in a timeline, can you talk about it a little bit? Because I thought there were some interesting underlying arguments that may have been inelegantly presented.
The arguments were basically terrible. I mean, on both sides, not terrible, but you know, it's even at 280 characters, Twitter makes everything dumber. So they didn't really get very well at the underlying surface of their arguments. And there was a fair amount of name calling. Taleb is, he seems to be unable to tolerate the idea that he might be wrong in any, or that somebody or smart person could disagree with him. And he is just tossing out the ad hominem attacks. And it was something.
And this is not biased because Phil Tetlock is sort of the godfather of the Good Judgment Project.
I mean, maybe I'm biased a little bit.
I'm not. I don't have any skin.
I have some bias. As far as I remember, at least from the timeline that Robert gave, he got into one ad hominem attack and then he apologized afterwards.
He apologized right away.
Yeah.
Well, maybe two. Talib- he did. There was a good dig that that pissed Taleb off. He at one point subtweeted him, as you might say, by referring to him as a best-selling author, which I think was a little bit like, you know, you're not a good academic kind of dig. Mm-hmm. And that really got under Taleb's skin.
But I think if you look at it, Taleb seems to be, or Taleb seems to be the aggressor. And it read very much to me like Tetlock was sort of trying to add some nuance and frame stuff and really sort of put a dispassionate spin on what you, I think, accurately present as ad hominem attack.
Yeah. And it wasn't just the two of them. At some point, Richard Thaler, the Nobel Prize winning economist, got involved on Tetlock's side. So I think it's about several different things. They've had sort of long-running disagreements, I guess. I think one issue is Taleb is very concerned about tail risk. So he talks about name checks, you know, the danger of GMOs. And the idea that, like, sure, it may be very likely, I think this is the idea, maybe very likely they're safe, but the tail risk is still unacceptable.
Right. Could be catastrophic.
Could be catastrophic. And I'm sympathetic to that point of view, although
me too.
The idea that anyone who disagrees with it is a complete idiot stooge is probably unfair. The other thing that we were talking about...
Let me interrupt for just a second. There's an op-ed. There's a guy, John Tierney, I think was his name. I may be getting the first name wrong, but Tierney, I think is right. He was a science writer, I believe, and also an op-ed writer for the New York Times, sort of lean conservative for a long time. And I remember reading an op-ed of his years ago where he talked about a bet he had made with a friend about food. Like, this is when people sort of had these bleat in the mid-70s.
Oh, this is the bet between Paul Ehrlich and Julian Simon, I think you're talking about.
Can you talk about it then?
So I actually wrote a little bit about this at one point.
Yeah, go.
So Paul Ehrlich wrote a book, I think it's called Population Bomb, back in the 70s, basically making extravagant claims about how we were all about to starve because the population was growing too much.
We're going to be eating each other by the mid-80s.
Yeah, I mean, really, and he later denied he made these claims, but they're right there in the book. They actually changed it, so the second edition had fewer of the changes of the extravagant claims. But an economist named Julian Simon bet him, basically said, you pick... The idea was basically that everything's going to become more scarce and more expensive. And Julian Simon made a bet with him essentially about a basket of commodities. You pick the commodities that you think are going to get more expensive over a 10-year period. And Simon won the bet. And Simon's point was economics, you know, there's a countervailing force. You can essentially innovate to lower prices.
Yeah, people solve problems.
Yeah, people solve problems. And so it's a mistake to project these population trends. And the same thing was true in food. We didn't starve because there were green revolutions, agricultural revolutions that increased the productivity of agricultural productivity around the world. So Simon basically won the bet. Ehrlich has never really recanted his position. It's fair to say that maybe Simon wouldn't have won the bet in every 10-year period. And maybe sometime we will start to run out of food.
No, I think that's right.
But the claims that Ehrlich made were clearly overheated and silly at the time. So it's a pretty significant sort of story in economics.
We've done enough forecasting now that we can get a sense of when someone's being alarmist. The Tierney piece, and I'm glad you knew about it, because for me, I remember Tierney making the bet, but clearly now I think he was just writing about the bet.
I don't know any Tierney story, but it could be that there's another bet.
I think you're right. But the underlying point, I remember even now reading it because like it feels right. We do tend to get alarmed by these kinds of risks, and I think appropriately so. Like when people talk about bees being decimated or widespread, you know, or climate change, widespread loss of animals, you know, like mass extinction. Yeah, these are things to be concerned about. On the other hand, people are really good at inventing solutions. And so I think it's important not to either go the very sanguine, borderline denial route, climate change is a hoax, like clearly it's not, it's a problem we need to be aware of, but also not to overreact and say, and this is why I think that some conservative commentators with climate change have a point, which is, yeah, we can acknowledge it's a problem, but I don't think that means that we immediately need to completely revamp our economy. Like maybe there is a middle path where we bend the curve, but we also assume that maybe believe that people may find solutions to these problems because historically they have. Like that to me feels like it's a reasonable argument, or at least it's something you can argue without saying one side or the other is completely moronic.
Right.
And I will add, because we talked about this a little bit, I believe, because I mentioned the Twitter beef with a friend of mine who works for a hedge fund, and he said Tlaib, I guess, is associated with a hedge fund that essentially bets against the market, like bets that there are going to be these kinds of cataclysmic black swan events or whatever, and
right,
and they're just hemorrhaging money because the market is soaring right now.
And they have over a long period of time.
Yeah, although as super forecaster, we talked about this on one of the forums and pointed out, you know, that that's kind of what you would expect. They'd hemorrhage money until they hit it big. I mean, that's the tail risk bet. So maybe it'll still work out.
Right.
It's also not clear that's Tlaib's fault.
With tail risk, I also look at it differently than betting money or investing money. And it would basically say, you know, you need to do risk analysis. Like if you're a company, what sort of things? Well, kind of back to the same issue of whether Robert should, you know, invest in a bunker. What are the areas where you could say this is not a good investment to actually buy five different companies based on what they're, you know, that they're going to have some tail risk event. But if you're running one of those companies, what sort of reasonable expense should you take to insure against it? And I give an example, really simple example, because that's what I am. But like when I had a painting company, law required things. Law may not require things in the future in terms of regulations, but having people work on roofs, you know, I put harnesses on them and ropes, you know, and so the chances of me falling off a roof at any given day are low, of one of my employees falling off a roof at any one given day are low, but the cost to mitigate any sort of damage from a slip is pretty minimal. You know, so that's different than saying I'm going to invest in a company based on bees completely disappearing. And like, what are reasonable precautions that can be taken?
Yeah, and I think that with tail risk, sometimes the thing that is the risk could be so catastrophic that you really want to insure against it. And it may even be that some kind of expected median value calculation isn't very a great way to do it, because, you know, the risk of catastrophe, you know, it's almost off the charts in a sense. So like you have to
right.
have to prevent that. I don't say not at all costs, but, you know, if you're talking about someone falling off a roof or nuclear war, these are things that you may want to go even further to stop, because it's not the medium outcome you're worried about, but the
right.
you know, the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the other thing that the argument was about whether skin in the game matters for prediction. And Tlaib says it does. He's a big fan of prediction markets. I think the record of prediction markets, or at least, you know, where you actually spend your own money, is somewhat mixed. I mean, I think the stock market does a very good job within its domain. It's very hard to beat that. But it's not, there's also, as Thaler pointed out, there's not a lot of really great evidence that people with skin in the game are necessarily good forecasters. There's also evidence that people who don't have a ton of the skin in the game can, like super forecasters, can outperform, even though they aren't betting on it.
But we actually have an experience with this, because all three of us came from a market-based system as far as becoming super forecasters.
Wasn't real money, but we did want to win.
It wasn't real money.
For status reasons.
We wanted to win, and it actually, becoming a super forecaster was a type of money. You know, that was actually something tangible that you could achieve.
We weren't going to lose much except our time.
We weren't going to lose anything, but we had something to gain. We had something significant to gain, and it was more than just having a, you know, a little gold star up on the board of your scores. But it actually meant, you know, a trip, in our case, a trip to Berkeley, seeing each other, but also being, you know, categorized as something that meant you had different advantages going into the future.
Sure. German papers are writing profiles about us.
Yeah, that's right. And now if that's no longer the case, then what keeps the interest level? Because for one thing that even Tetlock would say definitely helps as far as being a good forecaster, one of the things that they can do is they can test almost anybody and say, you know, based on your, essentially your IQ, but also based on how granular you are, you know, there's all sorts of tests they can do to say, do you have the probability of being a good forecaster? But they can't actually test very well, are you going to put the time in? So you have to actually believe that you can become a better forecaster, and you need to put in a decent amount of time in order to succeed. And that's something that they need to give enough questions and say, okay, let's, you know, look at a person for 3 months over 25 questions or something, and then they can become much more accurate as far as knowing who is going to be good at this. So cognitively, you could look at a person, do a series of tests and say, yeah, this person has potential. But if they don't care, they're not going to become a good forecaster, most likely. The caring could happen because of skin in the game, whether it's basically prestige of becoming a super forecaster, whether it's getting paid, you know, winning, losing. But there's something that has to make you want to keep going. For me, that could be simply certain questions I care about. So I don't want Hawaii blown off the map. You know, I don't know. There are certain ones that say, okay, I have more. Yeah, I have more care about that than maybe about some index fund, even though an index fund may have to do with somebody's retirement. And that matters too. You know, but so it can be money. It can be, you know, some intrinsic value.
But caring about a question doesn't make you a better forecaster. Caring about the accuracy might.
Well, it makes me want to put time in.
Yeah.
And if I have, you know, enough other things to do during the day, what makes me say I'm going to spend, you know, an hour or two a day each day? I got very involved in an Ebola question. For some reason, that one seemed very real to me, and I was more motivated to look at it than a lot of other questions. And so I don't know what makes certain questions become fascinating to the point where, you know, where I wouldn't say I become a subject matter expert, but at least say, you know, go in deeper than just scanning the New York Times each day.
You're investing your effort, but I'm not sure that's the kind of skin in the game that Tubbs is talking about. He's talking about, you know, you have money to lose something.
I understand.
And I think one of the points that Tetlock makes that I think is right is that that doesn't, like forecasters, even the best forecaster has to be motivated.
Yeah.
That's true because it's hard work, but that having skin in the game doesn't make you a good forecaster. It may mean the market aggregate Correct. Is pretty good, but there are some people you could give them as much stake as possible and they're still going to do dumb things with it.
Yeah, I actually think having a stake can be a problem. And I just based on, especially in the market.
It makes me risk averse.
Back when we were doing GGP and now when we're doing Predict It. I think anxiety is real. And I would exploit when I thought someone was getting anxious about a question.
Is that what you did to us?
You guys did it to yourself, frankly. But I will tell you, at the end of GJ, of the very first year, when my account was much higher than...
Than everyone else, we could be honest.
Than everyone else.
I would say the median or everyone else in the top 10.
I was like close to second place, 3 times my stake.
I will tell you why.
Just so everyone knows, Atif crushed everyone in that first year.
Everyone, yeah.
I think a big part of it was people at the end were anxious about being super forecasters.
I was.
Yeah. It was like they were so close to getting their owl to going to Hogwarts, they did not want to jeopardize that. And they were literally just like, I don't want to lose my top 2% or whatever the cutoff was status, as opposed to trying to maximize the value of the portfolio, which meant that suddenly there were a lot of good opportunities because no one wanted to.
Well, that was rational. I mean, that was rational because there's a cutoff point.
At that point, you're maximizing for something eternal.
It interferes with good forecasting because I literally at that point, I was thinking, I'm not going to push something to the utter limit. And part of this in a market was simply I might have fewer dollars invested in something that I thought was high risk, but I thought was going to come out well. It's like, if this is going to risk me not being a super forecaster, it's simply not worth it.
Right.
And that's been taken out for us now. We no longer have that fear in our professional forecasting.
I always want to be near the top of the, I want to be on the leaderboard.
Yeah.
That's very motivating for me. And it's probably a type of insanity because it's not that important.
It's really not. Sorry, Germany. It's cool. It's not super important. But yeah, one of the things, when they talk about skin in the game, to me, having too much invested in a question, I think, leads to an emotional attachment that makes it harder for people to see questions, to evaluate a question objectively. Like anxiety, and I know I've talked about this before, I think there's a strong emotional component or emotion management component to forecasting. And when people get anxious about a question, either because of the content of the question or because of some overlaying factor, such as whether or not you become a super forecaster or some other title at the end of it, whatever the German term for uber forecaster, it affects how they're approaching the question, right? Because now they're trying to maximize something other than an accurate forecast for the question itself. So speaking of skin in the game, we have a predicted account that we've all been messing with. Like we've all been sort of contributing to it. It's been a lot of fun and we've had ups and downs.
We were all up for a while. We hit on everything at first.
Recently, we took some hits, and some of them were State of the Union questions, right? Like, they're predicted had a set of questions, which were, will President Trump say this, or say this, or what would the viewership be for the State of the Union? None of those is a particularly good bet, for a variety of reasons.
I thought the North Korea one was a good bet.
You're right. It ended up paying out, and it became a better bet. Like, it surged unpredicted, once there was a CNN report prior to the speech that he was going to talk about North Korea.
Well, but I thought it was almost guaranteed. We bought it at like an 80% chance. I thought it was almost guaranteed. So that's a pretty good return for a week or so.
I lost money on a question, which was, will he say fake news? For me, it was priced low. I thought it was more likely that he wouldn't than he would. Like, I never thought the chance was over 50%. But I thought it was mispriced in the market. So the expected return to me was greater than what I was going to put in, even though I still expected to lose money.
Your theory was that he was just going to blurt out fake news, that he just couldn't sit still for an hour without saying the phrase.
Right. We can talk about it. So I thought there were two ways it would happen. I thought, one, if it was an antagonistic speech, it might literally be in the text of the speech. Like, there might be something that talked about the fake news media trying to derail our agenda or something like that. And then there was a report the day of, maybe the day before, that the White House was releasing segments of the speech, and it was going to strike an optimistic, conciliatory tone. And we know now, for our foreign listeners, it's all bullshit. And anything he says in a speech, it's immaterial to what they're actually going to do. But it did make me think, okay, well, it's now less likely that he's probably going to do this kind of antagonizing statement in what's supposed to be a healing speech. So I reduced our stake in the question, but I still left some in, because at that point
I should have adapted a little bit or updated after his Davos speech, because his Davos speech, he stayed truly to the teleprompter through the entire thing. It was only afterwards, when they sat down and gave him questions, that he brought up fake news. And that was probably one of the first times I've seen him actually go through an entire speech where he wasn't going native.
That's why I was skeptical, though, because also the inaugural address last year, it was very, I mean, it made every CNN pundit say the word presidential. He stepped to the script, more or less. Some approximate adult wrote that speech.
No approximate adult wrote that speech.
Approximate. I mean, we're not talking about real professional, serious people. We're talking about...
He was speaking about carnage. Carnage in America.
Oh, that's right. Blood the Streets. It's like a Doors song.
It was Stephen Miller.
Yeah.
At least he didn't wet himself, right. You know?
Right. So for that question, it dipped into the mid-20s. And I thought, you know, again, yeah, we might lose money on it. We're probably going to lose money on it. But it still seemed like a bet I was just willing to make. But it's when I do that forecast, the investment matters. But I don't feel passionate about it. Like, I think it would be easy if you sort of, that stake made you anxious one way or another about Trump's speech. Because I knew people who, like, well, we talked about who was going to watch the speech because we knew one of us wanted to.
No, I have a low tolerance for ethno-nationalism.
But no one particularly wanted to watch it.
Yeah. It was more painful than I thought to watch it.
I don't like spin. I don't want to sit for an hour and a half and be spun to.
But you got up at 4 a.m. to watch it.
Yeah.
You were the only one who watched it, and you were the one who its time zone it wasn't in.
Yep.
Yeah, thank you. Took one for the team.
Yeah. Thanks, Scott. Took a bullet for the team, buddy. But anyway, now that we are active on Predict It, sort of getting back to the skin in the game, I enjoy it. I enjoy doing it with you guys. You know, we go up some, we go down some, whatever. I do think, though, I see in the comments, there's a lot of pumping and dumping, and there seems to be a lot of effort. And we saw this the very first year of GJP as well, to kind of advocate zealously for position in a way that makes people anxious. And I'm sure you guys remember, there would be comment sections, and the comment sections for the forecasters is much better than the predicted stuff, which is could border a dumpster fire. But even in the curated, cultivated, anodyne GJP comment sections, you would still get people get like really into a question, and you could see it reflected in their bets. And some of those people got weeded out. Like, a lot of the people I kind of knew that first year were probably not going to be top performers because they got emotionally invested in the question and it affected them.
Yeah, when you get ego at stake with your idea, then you can't change it when it's wrong.
Oh, it's a problem. Correct. Or when you want an outcome. And there are a lot of questions where people wanted, and I could tell there were classes of questions, Middle East questions. A lot of people have emotional stakes in outcomes, and I thought it really affected how they forecast to the detriment. Like, you kind of want to forecast as a semi-psychopath. You want to care, but you don't want to really care. You want to seem like you care.
You've got to be dispassionate. I mean, it's one thing to have a part of you that has empathy for everyone involved, but I think that you have to really take an outside view and act like it's almost like a math problem with no real people.
It's strange to me because, like, with Middle East questions, or at least with his questions on Israel, I felt like I could be dispassionate on some portions. So if it came down to discussions about negotiating a peace treaty, I felt like I can view it objectively. But when it comes to things actually like elections, if the elections are close at all, then I think I basically get swayed towards the side that I want to win anyway, because the other side just seems so loathsome to me that it's like, it can't be this way. It can't be that over half the people are going to vote for somebody who's basically, I feel, pushing towards war, whether that's in US, whether it's in Israel, wherever. And I think that's something that I have to work on is, you know, and I think basically Trump has helped, if I can say anything positive about Trump, this is something he's helped me on, is to say, no, I'm no longer of the opinion that, don't worry, at least half the people are going to, you know, stop us from our worst tendencies.
Yeah, I agree. Let's segue to, unless there's something I just want to say about the Tetlock Tlaib stuff.
One thing I would say about it is the type of discussion that they had there is something that we actually really, really don't do within our own forecasting. So since GJP is over as a company when we're working, I really think that by and large, we've done a good job of keeping away from ad hominem attacks. And so generally, the discussions are around the topic, not about, you know, somebody's mother. And I think that does actually benefit.
Yeah. Back to Skin the Game. Let's talk sort of general national politics. The news recently that Rep. Gowdy is not going to be running for, not only not running for re-election, but apparently he's just done with politics. He's going to, I guess there's some judicial post that he may be assuming, but he's just getting out. Right now, Republican members of the House, there are many of them who are saying they're not going to run for re-election. It's looking like it's going to be a kind of grim season. It's not clear whether Democrats will take the House, but maybe. It's not clear whether Democrats will take the Senate, but maybe. I think 538 had Senate chance in a recent Nate Silver piece at about 20%. But it does seem to me like Republicans are... Trey Gowdy was a guy who was known for the Benghazi investigation. And there's open acknowledgement the last few years that it was a nakedly partisan investigation. There was one of the reps, Richard Hanna, who's a Republican, who said, it's just the way Washington works. And that you'd want to think that they would be better, but they ended up just spending millions of dollars trying to depress Hillary Clinton's poll numbers. And so it strikes me, like Chaffetz, I think, was another guy who had an oversight position. It seems to me thought it would be fun to be in the minority and just to harass people actually trying to sort of pass legislation, and do not like having skin in the game, do not like being now people who are responsible for the country. And Flake is similar to me. Flake is one of those guys who can say all the right things, but is declined to run for re-election. There is a sense for me, a lot of congressional Republicans are sort of jumping ship. They wanted power. Now that they're in a position of power, they don't really know how to govern. I think this is a criticism that has been leveled against them on the right or the left.
Do you give any credence to the idea that it's not just that they don't like to govern, but that governing with this president is a pretty tough case? Now, in the case of Flake, I may buy that. In the case of Gowdy, I'd have a hard time.
Yeah, a lot of them advocated for Trump. Like, a lot of them knew what they were getting and went out and stumped for him.
Yeah, they're not very effectual, and they're having to defend things they probably don't want to defend. This can't be very much fun, and a lot of them are facing the possibility they could lose in the fall.
Yes.
So I think they're jumping ship, and I don't...
That's right.
I think it's an indicator it probably will be a blowout or, you know, a huge way for the Democrats. Although it should be said that recently the generic congressional ballot has been tightening. I think it has something to do with the tax bill that we saw. It seemed like that there was a big bump after that.
Yeah, we'll see how that plays out.
I don't think it'll last. I don't think it'll last, but you have to update your odds for the fall a little bit on that basis.
Well, apparently, yeah, the Trump administration was trying to front load the tax benefits by leaning on employers to withhold less so that after the 2018 midterms, when people have to pay their taxes for this fiscal year, they may say, oh my God, I owe money. But they will immediately see a benefit in their salaries or in their incomes because employers are not withholding based on what they should for the tax bill. So there's an attempt to just sort of buy time through this midterm election and then see where things go.
Also, I think that the tax plan, most people don't want to pay more taxes. And basically the tax plan, even though it gave the majority of the cuts to the top very, you know, small portion of 1% plus corporations, it is giving across the board tax cuts to most everybody, with the exception of losing healthcare issues. But this actually is at a cost in terms of debt, and debt actually does matter. And this is where...
And government services.
Yeah. And...
But taxes pay for those.
If you're adding, you know, several trillion dollars to the debt, but it was for infrastructure, if it, you know, was for something that was meaningful, then that's fine. But those consequences are not going to be borne out in the next year. You know, so... The worst things that are going to come from the tax cut will not happen before the midterm elections, and they probably won't even happen before the next presidential election.
I think it'll be a small net benefit in terms of, you know, lower taxes and not much lower services for most people in the first year. I don't think it's going to make a significant impression on people. I think the people don't know exactly what they're going to pay on taxes. And if they pay an extra, you know, save an extra $100, $200, it's not going to make a huge difference to people. So I don't expect it to be a huge boost for Republicans. I think the bump really comes from the fact that Republicans didn't look incredibly ineffectual, and maybe their donors are happy, or I think that's a big part of why they got a bump in the generic ballot.
They had to pass something, and there's another issue that doesn't show up in the U.S. much, which is the stock market keeps going up, but also part of that is we have a weak dollar, so the dollar's kept going down and down, and being
a weak Bitcoin too.
Yeah. But I think the dollar affects a few more people, and that's
fair.
Yeah, and so you know, basically, I think it's lost. I should know this better, but it's something like, but somewhere between 15% and 20% since Trump took office, and I should find out the number. But you know, that's actually consequential, and so some of the policies, you know, a person may see more money in their pocket if you're not actually traveling overseas on a yearly basis. You probably don't actually see what that means. But it does have an effect. It could also have the effect of creating some more jobs. I mean, a weak dollar is not all bad. You know, basically, a lot of the consequences are not things that I think the average person will pick up on right away.
Should affect the trade deficit, right? I think that's in a direction that Trump would like, although the effect hasn't been huge so far.
So we have some time before the midterm elections, obviously. We have this Mueller investigation. Predicta has a lot of questions about related to the Mueller investigation, but just in general, because we haven't had a sort of conversation politics-related podcast in about a month or so. How do you guys see it playing out, just sort of long-term? And one of the things we're going to do in the next couple of weeks is and we'll talk about it later, but do a longer-term podcast, like a 10, 20-year podcast, just sort of general, where do we see the world going? But for this next year, where do you guys see the Mueller investigation going? Like, how do you see it playing out? What do you think is the one or two most likely scenarios by the end of this year?
I don't think Mueller will conclude by the end of this year. I think one of the things people don't realize is that Mueller can't legally really indict the president because he doesn't really have the authority under the office. You know, the Department of Justice has sort of ruled that you can't do that in the past. He is supposed to ultimately not even refer stuff to Congress. He's supposed to refer it back to Department of Justice. So that's Rod Rosenstein. And I think that he may start to make referrals, but I don't think that the investigation on its own will wrap up. And then there's the question of whether those referrals get sent to Congress. Congress could presumably subpoena them or get the information anyway, but it's not clear the Republican Congress will. So I think either he starts to make referrals, or at some point Trump demands he's fired and there's a version of the Saturday Night Massacre. And I really don't know what will happen if that happens. I don't know whether or not there'll be enough of an outcry to really force Trump to stop or to even remove him. In my own opinion, whatever happens to the Mueller investigation, it won't really matter unless Democrats retake or, you know, do really well in Congress in the midterms. And then if they do really well in Congress in the midterms, then they have the ability to make sure to protect the Mueller investigation and, you know, decide if action needs to be taken. If the Democrats don't, then the Mueller investigation, even if it wraps up, it probably doesn't go anywhere.
I'm curious if you're Mueller. I know he's supposed to be nonpartisan, but still, if he has what he knows is a strong case, but knows that almost no matter what he brings forward right now wouldn't lead to impeachment just because Congress is unlikely to go that way unless it's something really extraordinary, would he be likely to try to drag it out past the election to give it a chance? Because I would assume that if he has...
I bet he would.
If he dumps all the information in July, let's say he has everything in July.
So the investigation will take longer than that anyway.
I'm just making hypothetical. So if he had actually enough, let's say if you had a strong, if Democrats had a strong majority in both the House and the Senate, it could be that in July he'd be like, oh yeah, I've got enough here. We need to move on this because there have been so many, you know, the seriousness of the crime is enough that we should move. But if you know that it's not going to work anyway, then you'd say, okay, let's bide our time until it has a chance to, you know, to succeed. I don't know.
I think he might try to gain the system in that way. I think it's absurd to think it's a partisan thing for him. He's not a partisan Democrat who's out to get Republicans.
No.
But I think he's a prosecutor who wants to make the case, and particularly if he thinks that somebody has really committed a crime.
Yeah.
And I bet he does. I think his team would like to see these crimes, there's some kind of justice for them. So I think they will try to present them in the most favorable forum. So yeah, I think that they would prefer to refer it to a Democratic Congress rather than a Republican Congress that might just sit on them even if they're real crimes.
So there's been a lot of talk about, there was a report recently that Trump had made moves to fire, laid the groundwork for firing Mueller last year, and then been talked out of it, the White House attorney.
Theoretically, he'd actually even given the order.
Yeah, and the White House said he would resign.
There are two different conflicting reports about exactly what happened. One of the reports was that maybe the order had been relayed and that McGahn had just tabled it and hoped Trump would forget. So I'm not really sure what happened then.
When that came out, there were some members of the media said, no one cares, who cares? Some members of Congress said, no one cares, who cares? But then there were some Republicans who said, if he did that, I think Lindsey Graham was quoted as saying, if he did that, if he fired Mueller, that would be the end of his presidency.
Yeah.
I don't think any of us think that would be. Or do you think that would be the end of his presidency if you fired Mueller?
I don't know. I could see it going either way. I think it should probably be the end of his presidency.
So what do you think the probability is? Because Predict It Right Now has a question. Will Mueller be replaced by June 30th? Yes is at 26%.
What does replaced mean? Like, is it going to have a new special counsel?
Yeah.
I don't.
So I think that there's two issues. One of them is it appears that Trump's administration is trying to make a case that that many people on the special counsel are biased to the point where they're no longer trustworthy. And I don't actually buy that, but that's, so one is, can they have something where they could say, look, even with Mueller, I know, here's something, and I think this would be very tough to do, but we have real grounds to get rid of him. And even if those grounds are shaky for me, are they enough that a Republican could basically buy it? And then the next thing would be, getting rid of him coincide with the same time that information is being leaked out that there's something extraordinarily bad that the Trump administration has done. You know, so if it's at the stage that it's at now, I already think that there's a lot going on. But if it was, okay, they were getting rid of him, and by the way, here's some, I don't know, we have Trump directly speaking with the Russians. We find out that his finances are, you know, that he's owes money to the Russians and he's made a deal with them, whatever. If there's something really, really damning and he gets rid of Mueller at that time, then I think it would be hard. It'd be harder for the Republicans to just say, oh, well, we got rid of that crooked investigation. You know, I think already, to me, any reasonable person would say that there's a lot of there. But I think they would need more there for the Republicans to actually care.
I think if the question is,
they need to be really covered for their own personal midterm safety.
If the question is, will Trump be rapidly impeached after firing Mueller? I'd say the answer is no. I think it's unlikely. You need, was it 67 votes in the Senate to impeach him? Or not to impeach him, to convict him.
Right.
I don't even know if he would get impeached in the House. So I think that answer is probably no. But I do think in a way it would be the end of his effective presidency, probably. There'd be a huge blowback among, you know, people who aren't in his base.
But what would that mean? Because he's still, what powers would he not have that he has now?
I think that there would be, I think there'd probably be protests, pretty intense protests for a while.
Sure.
I think that people would seriously, in Congress, would seriously consider, you know, how they're going to lose their seats. And I also think there's been talk, supposedly, this has been reported that Trump wants to prosecute Mueller, which is just insane because it's not like there's evidence that Mueller's committed any crime. Trump would just like to see him prosecuted. This is some serious show trial, banana republic kind of stuff. But let's say he tried to do something like that, tried to replace Mueller, prosecute him. The stuff that Mueller has discovered is still going to probably come out. And I just think that the more they do this, the more sand there is in the gears of his presidency, the more likely it is there's a Democratic wave. I think that basically it's a little bit like a Chinese finger trap. The more Trump tries to pull out of this, I think this is what his lawyers probably will tell him, what Don McGahn probably told him, the more you try to pull out of it by just firing people, the worse you make it for yourself.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Anything else you guys want to share with what you did last month before we wrap up? Do you have a bug out bag, Robert?
Yeah, it's not very good, though. It's not really stocked.
Do you want me to send you something for your bug out bag? I don't know what it would be. Iodine?
Batteries, power bars. I've got some clean water.
Do you have a bug out bag, Scott?
Of course Scott does.
I never considered that I have one, but I guess I just travel permanently with one. So that's, yeah.
Yeah. How many passports did you say you had, Scott?
Only a couple, but they're... No, I don't have three. I'm not up to Manafort standard.
That is what I'd say, the Manafort special.
I had to get a new one because I filled up the pages on my last one. No, basically, it's funny because a lot of people here figure that I used to be in Special Forces or in the CIA or something like that, which I wasn't. But I carry.
You weren't in Special Forces?
No, but I used to go shoot with those guys. And I have, I always carry like a very good sleeping bag and basic.
Are you a good shot?
I like to shoot, but I don't have a gun. I just like to borrow them. I don't believe in carrying guns around.
Right, you use the weapons God gave you. Use your hands.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
And your mind, obviously.
Yeah, sure. No.
Your mind's your nine, your pen's your
man. My grandpa gave me a gun so I could shoot the communists, so I was trained. Basically.
Don't you know the communists are our allies now?
Oh, crap.
I used to have a Young Pioneer scarf.
No, I never had that. I probably have what would be considered a bug out bag, but I just don't think of it that way. I just think about it for like being stuck in the snow if I'm traveling between cities, because I've had enough experiences like that.
Well, you're always on the move.
Yeah, that's true.
You never settle down in any one place.
Yeah, like Gaddafi. I shouldn't say like Gaddafi. Didn't do him any good.
Like Gaddafi.
You have spider holes all over Europe, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Safe houses.
Maybe Lorenzo Lamas from Renegade. Just ride around on your motorcycle. Your feathered hair cascading behind you. All right. We'll be back next week. Nonprofitspod.wordpress.com. Nonprofitspod@gmail.com. And we have a lot of stuff we talked about. The German newspaper piece we'll put up there. I think we may do our interview with Katie next, which was a lot of fun. And then we'll be back. We'll talk politics, predict it. And there's a book that I would like you guys to read. We'll talk about it. And then we can do some longer-term forecasts. I think it would be kind of cool to sort of do a 20, 30-year forecasting horizon. What do you think is going to happen? Maybe we can solicit people on a GGI Basecamp and get some of their ideas. Okay, guys. All right. I'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Talk to you later.